Welcome back to The Slow Dive, where we explore the intersections of impact, community, and storytelling. I'm your host, Farida Rafiq. We are flowing along on season two. Today's episode is another installment of Farida and Friends, where I sit down with creative minds who are shaping culture and expanding the narrative. Joining me from Brooklyn, New York is the intrepid writer-director, Shauna Darabee. A daughter of Trinidadian immigrants, Shauna brings a vibrant and multidimensional voice to filmmaking. Her journey has taken her from fashion design to motion graphics to the world of screenwriting and directing. She's racked up an impressive list of accolades, including the Devery Freeman Memorial Award for screenwriting for her sci-fi horror feature, Facsimile. In 2023, her sci-fi pilot, Clones, was a finalist for the Circle of Confusion Writers Discovery Fellowship. And her feature, Super Villainous, was a finalist for both the WGAE and Film Nation New York Screenwriting Fellowship and a semi-finalist for the Writers Lab and Almanac Screenwriters October Colony. Shauna currently works as a development associate at the Department of Motion Pictures and has directed, written, and produced a range of commercials and shorts. She's also preparing to star in her debut feature. In today's conversation, we dive into films, mental health awareness, and the importance of staying in community as artists and people. It's going to be a rich, grounded, full of perspective conversation. Welcome, Shauna.
Hi, Farida. How's it going?
It's going good. How are you?
All right. We had days of rain recently, which it's like, it's dreary, but at the same time, I'm like, we had a drought, like, we've had several droughts recently, so I'm like, yeah, rain as much as you need to. So,
I mean, I feel your happiness, Derek, being in Southern California. We love the rain too. It's very important for us. So I love that. I'm glad. So, okay, starting right off, first of all, thank you for being a co-host today during Mental Health Awareness Month. Appreciate it, Shauna. Huge fan of your work and your films, which we're going to get into a little bit later. But to start us off with, we have an icebreaker question for our co-host and guest. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. So let's start. What's a family tradition, dish, or recipe you love most to make in honor of your family or traditions?
That's a hard one because I don't know how to make any Trinidadian food at all. Which I know sounds terrible, but I'm like, there are all these great roti shops and doubles places I can just go to where someone is already doing a really great job of that. So I leave that to the professionals, as terrible as that sounds. But my son currently really loves, there's this tofu and broccoli thing I make sometimes that he really likes. So I guess that, though I put a little bit of shrimp paste on it, so it's not exactly vegetarian. It's almost vegetarian, but not completely.
Are you vegetarian?
I technically am not. Like, I'll occasionally eat chicken and fish, but I have to admit, with the recent announcements that they're pulling back on, like, regulations and inspections, I'm like, maybe I can, like, wait 4 or 5 years to eat chicken and fish.
Okay, so you don't cook any Trinidadian recipes. Is there a favorite one you like to eat or that recalls a nostalgic memory of yours?
So my two favorite Trinidadian things are, there's doubles. I passionately love doubles, and bus upshot with curry chickpeas and, well, curry chana and potatoes. So it's, I didn't really learn the word chickpeas until adulthood. I was knew it as chana, and then out of nowhere I'm like, what, that's called something else in this country? Crazy. But
yeah, we call in South Asian cuisine, we also call chickpeas garbanzo beans chana as well. So that's kind of cool. Yeah, that we have that common.
Well, I think it's the whole Trinidad was a British colony, which means there's a lot of Black people, South Asian people, and East Asian people. So you get all of those foods. So it's like West African food, South Asian food, and some Chinese food just kind of all blended together. And it's a great combination. So try Trinidadian food. It will delight you.
No, I've heard of doubles a lot. I've never had it here, but it's definitely something I want to try because all what you just said, the different spices and cultural inspiration in the cuisine sounds very fascinating. And that's just something I like to ask because I know we're going to get into some heavy stuff as an icebreaker. So I was like, oh, let's ask about this. Another question, Shauna, what is your superpower if you had one? Or you do have one. What is your superpower?
I get horribly car sick and seasick, and I also get sick in planes. So I would love to be able to teleport. That would make traveling so much better if I could just pop in and pop out where I need to be and not have to worry about that whole getting on a plane thing. Oh my God, I get so sick on planes. And I take lots of Dramamine to the point that it no longer makes me drowsy. I can pop Dramamine and stay awake the entire time. Yeah, my body is just like, oh, we're familiar with this.
Well, you know, that's actually a great superpower to have, teleportation. And who knows, maybe not in our lifetime, but in the future, we might just get there. I mean, we're already in the metaverse. And we're already, you know, in that area. So we got AIs ahead of us. So who knows? Maybe someone's already figured out a way to teleport. We just haven't.
I've heard it will probably never work because there's the whole issue of it's like you have to transport every single atom and get it in this same exact spot. And I'm like, oh, yeah, we're not figuring that out.
I'm not figuring that out. Maybe someone will. It's fascinating. It's cool. I'm so glad you're here because it'll be fun to talk about our first segment, which is 5 ways art and creativity support mental health. And you're a artist, a storyteller, a filmmaker, a writer. So before we get into the 5 segments, is there a project or something in time before you came into film directing that you were like, I need to do this for the rest of my life. I need to just create for the rest. When did you know you had to get into creativity? And how did you feel? How early on did you
know? It's so weird because it's just like, it wasn't really something I thought about. I was always that kid that was making up stories. We went to the movies as a family throughout my entire childhood. Like, the first movie I saw in theaters, I was probably about 3. So it's like my parents, they're immigrants. They don't understand the idea of paying someone to watch your child. So they just took me everywhere with them. And then they did the same when they had my sister. So we always just, my parents wanted to go to the movies. All of us went. So yeah, movies have just always been a thing. We watched, this may sound terrible to some people, but we watched TV as we ate dinner. So it was like we watched, you know, Fresh Prince, like dinner in Fresh Prince, or it was dinner in Seinfeld. So yeah, it's like, so storytelling has always been this thing that was like just a part of my life. And when it came to like deciding a career, I didn't, like in high school, I did not think of film because I was just like, oh, I don't know how that happens. I don't know how these stories are made. Even though I was really obsessed with, there used to be, I think it was on Discovery Channel, this show called Movie Magic, where they showed how they did all the special effects. And I became very obsessed with Bigatures. I thought they were the coolest thing in the world. I loved Bigatures and saw how they used them to make, what's that movie? The Daryl Hannah Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. So it was like, oh my God, this is so awesome. But It's like, well, where would you go to school to learn how to do that? I don't know. So I went into fashion design because I knew I wanted to do something creative. But I was like, okay, I know there's fashion school. So I'll go to fashion school because I knew I couldn't just become a sculptor because I have immigrant parents and that would be out of the question. But yeah, I worked in fashion for a while. And the crazy thing about having a child is you suddenly realize you can die and it's coming soon. And so I was just like, oh my God, I have to figure out this film thing. And finally, like, started looking into it. And from then, I, like, started making films and, like, writing stories. I had been writing off and on over the years, but finally, like, learned screenplay format. And I would, like, write scripts in Word, which is a nightmare to do because it's like you're sitting there like fixing all the tabs for every little thing. It's awful. But yeah, I eventually did buy Final Draft.
This is really cool because like I was, so you are immersed in creativity as a child, just loved the, but you didn't know until later, like your second career, that you wanted to actually write films, make films, right?
I always knew I wanted to storytell. Like, I used to come up with comic book characters when I was a kid. I love comics. I started reading since, I think the first ever comic I read was Supergirl. And I read Archie's Digest for a while. And then in, like, the 90s, when everything was extreme, I was into, like, X-Men and Wildcats and Spawn. And yeah, loved all that stuff, watched the cartoons. And so it's like I would come up with all these characters and teams and be like, oh, okay, this character, she's from the future and she's gone into the past and she has to prevent this cataclysm. Because I was like, oh, I'll just do Days of Future Past, but like my version of it with my characters that are essentially mutants, but not mutants. But yeah, and you know, I loved coming up with all that stuff, and, like, I did draw as a kid, so it was, like, I would draw, like, characters and come up with their costumes and, like, all sorts of stuff. I remember coming up with a character named Plasma as a kid and showing her to my dad and being like, yeah, she shoots plasma from her hands, and my father, being a chemical engineer, was like, that's not possible. Giving me the whole, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, no, this is good because, like, I think the audience can hear the joy in you talking about how you create ideas, and that's generally the point, like, right? Creativity supports mental health. So I'm just going to start with a 2016 study said that 45 minutes of creative activity lowers cortisol by 75%.
That's amazing.
Cortisol.
That's amazing.
Right? And then I'm just going to, this is just the information entertainment portion of today's episode. It also boosts brain function and focus. It activates the reward system and promotes neuroplasticity, which is always good, right? It also stimulates the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in focus and decision-making. So creativity is linked to improved problem-solving skills. So that all that imagination, writing those plot twists, it all lends to better mental health. Social connection and community, right? Like, film is very collaborative, right? I mean, the whole process, how many people do you work with, Shauna, from A to Z, from pre-production to post-production?
Oh, like, my God. Yeah, I was actually talking to someone earlier about, like, my most recent short film. I was like, oh, my God, I had something like 20 or 30 extras. A lot of them were kids. There were dogs, multiple dogs. And I was just like, but it wasn't stressful. Like, I wasn't like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? It was like, okay, we planned everything in advance. Now I just need to go and direct. It's okay. So, yeah.
I think all of us, at least who are in the film or the indie film space specifically, I think it's not for the money at the beginning. It's never for the money. It's literally for the sheer joy of creating these stories and bringing them to life, right? Like, it's just that it's seeing, like, I don't know, and please feel free to chime in, like, just like knowing you have this idea in your mind's eye, then you draft it, and then you have a production designer, and then you have the gaffer, and you have the prop master, and all of a sudden, everything that was in your brain, one day you were just like maybe driving or walking somewhere, and you have this idea, it's now a 20-minute film or a 90-minute indie feature. I think that's pretty freaking amazing.
It's so cool, because it's like, I think a big part of being a good writer and director is it's like you have to be able to take this idea from your head and then first get it onto the page, and then you have to get other people to understand this thing that's been a vision in your head, and then they're going to have their own ideas, and then it's like the actors get involved and they're going to interpret it in their own way, but you also have, there's that push and pull between getting them to understand your vision and then you're understanding how they're interpreting it. And it's like, it does not end up being the thing you initially conceived in your head, like whatever many years ago. But if you do it right, it'll be better than what you imagined.
What was the first film that you brought to life? Like, that was from a script that was your first, like, piece of work in your portfolio?
I would say I always knew I wanted to write, but I realized that, hey, I could do this directing thing because I was taking a class at SBA and the teacher broke us up into teams of three. He was like, one of you will be the director and come up with the story. One of you will be the actor and one of you will do the camera. And I was like, that camera thing, because it was a film camera, and I was just like, I do not want to fuck that up. I'm sorry about swearing. And I was like, I do not want to act. Terrible idea. So it was like, in that moment, I came up with a story, and then I had to, like, explain it to the actor and get him to understand. And then I tell the, like, DP who is using this camera for the first time how I wanted this filmed. And I was just like, oh my God. That was amazing. I love doing this. And I would say that was the moment I realized I wanted to direct, because I always knew I wanted to write, but doing, like, directing for the first time was just like, oh, whoa, this is so cool. And it's like this silent short film I did at SVA. It's on my website. It's called Teacher Appreciation Day. It's a goofy little, like, 2-minute short. And yeah, I had so much fun. I was like, yes, I'm going to keep directing. And then found out that making films is very expensive. So it's not exactly just always you just get together with your friends and make something. Like, that does not happen as that fast all the time. But it was like an amazing experience.
So yeah, so it also encourages mindfulness and flow. It brings us into the flow state. So flow state, like, I describe flow state as, like, basically when you're just, like, writing uninterrupted. And you're, like, you're just, like, I don't know. I'm not, like, into, like, the psychic arts. I'm not a medium or a channel or anything like that. But to me, when I feel like I'm doing something seamlessly without any overthinking or stopping myself, I'm in the stream of it. That's what flow state is for me. And it is truly a good feeling. Have you practiced flow state or found, what's your process like?
So my writing process, it's funny because it's like, I start with the treatment phase. Well, first, actually, I would say I start with the idea phase where I'm just thinking about this idea and that could last years. And then it's like the treatment takes forever. And it's funny, you, like, sit down with you to make your treatment where it's just like a prose thing of starts here, this is the middle, this is the end, and it takes forever even though you already know this stuff in your head. And then it's like, once I've, like, got that concrete, I can, like, do my outline where it's like we're really getting the bones of it, and that also takes me forever. But then, like, once I've got an outline I'm happy with, it takes me, like, a week or two to finish a script. So it's like, yeah, yeah, it's because I spend so much time on my outline and treatment, so I can just rush through the script itself and then be like, oh, okay, I did that. But it there's this, like, weird aspect of every time you start a new story, there's just, like, this scary, like, oh my god, am I capable of doing this? I don't know. Like, sure, did it 10 times or whatever. I don't know if I'm still capable of doing it. How did I do it the last few times? But then, like, once you get to that flow where you're just, like, you've figured all the things out and you've ordered all those imaginary scenes that have been floating your head, it's just, like, goes free. And it just all comes out of you so easily. It just takes a while to get there.
Yeah, no, that's pretty incredible and amazing that it takes you a couple of days to write a screenplay, because I feel like I consider myself more of a producer, director, writer, if I had to list it, because I feel like I can get the ideas, I can conceptualize it, but my inner critic and my perfectionism, even if I know I have it all in my head and I'm sitting down, the formatting, the structure of screenwriting trips me up, and it just takes me forever. So I'm just like, this is what holds me back, because I love doing the outlines. I have the characters down, but yeah, I mean, I'm still working on that.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, since the pandemic, we're almost like half a decade since the pandemic. Did you ever, what do you think, or some examples, like, creative community helped us during, like, times of crises?
I could say one of the great things has been the whole advent of writers groups on Zoom. There's suddenly not that you have to live in LA or New York, even though I do live in New York, but it was just like, there was suddenly this, like, okay, I have this weekly thing every Wednesday at, like, this particular time. We're going to get together and discuss storytelling. And yeah, there's a lot of shooting the shit before we get to the storytelling stuff beforehand. But it was, like, really great to just have this, okay, we're going to do this every Wednesday. And, like, I had been part of writers groups before COVID, and there was, like, one I did on Zoom before COVID. Actually, did I do? I think I did that one post-COVID also. But, like, there was one I'd met with here in New York that was, like, weekly, and we met in person, but it would just be like, oh, winter's here. I don't feel like getting on the train and going to Manhattan. It's wet outside and it's cold. But it was just, like, suddenly with Zoom, there was no excuse, because I was like, oh, I just have to pull out my laptop. And I have no excuse to not talk to people. And I think that's been really great, because with remote work, it can be very lonely. Like, the company I work for right now, we all work from home. And it's awesome, because that's given me time to do other things. But at the same time, it's like, I'm not seeing as many people, but I'm like, okay, I'm in these writers groups. We're seeing each other. Maybe not every single week, but I'm talking to other adults. And it's not about, you know, house management and homework and stuff. It's like about, hey, did you see that new vampire movie? Or, you know,
I think now, since, like I said, half a decade from the pandemic's onset, I think the Zoom communities are so normalized now. Like, I don't remember before the pandemic even using FaceTime. Like, I was just, like, a text person, and now everything is, like, Zoom and that. But I love it. I love it. And I think, I don't know about you, Shauna, but I'm a naturally awkward, introverted person. So for me, I love my space on Zoom and writers group. But my question to you, because I know you're a member of a writer's group, what would you tell someone, and this is something I dealt with in the beginning when I first started sharing my writing, like, what do you tell someone if they're not like, because I feel like you have to be vulnerable to share your writing and in a community. And that was very challenging for me because I can write for myself and I'm like, oh yeah, that's good. I like it. But then it's like, you feel like it's naked and it's like very vulnerable, especially if you want to write something really like if you're writing something that's, I don't know, dramatic or something based on like true life. Like, how do you get over yourself and share your writing in a safe space? Like, what would you, are there any tips like for people who are thinking of joining a writer's group?
Well, I would say probably the most mercenary thing is like, go on Tubi and watch a movie like The Uninvited, or, you know, Don't Go Into the Woods, something terrible. It's like, that got made, someone read that script and was like, yes. And it's like, you know what? You can probably write something better. It's like, feel good about that. There's Neil Breen has made multiple movies. And people watch them. And sure, some people are like, these are terrible. But he got to tell his story to millions of people. So it's just like, who cares if someone out there doesn't like it? There's someone else out there that will. That's what really matters, is that someone else will like it. And on top of that, that you're telling the story that you need to tell. Because you can't really go into storytelling with like, okay, vampires are in right now. We're in this wave where it's this particular type of scary vampire that is also sexy. You can't do that. It's, okay, what do you want to read? What do you want to see? What are the stories that reach you? And, you know, essentially make stuff for yourself. And the more you care about it, the better it's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. And as far as vampires, have you seen Sinners?
I did.
I love it. It's going down as like one of my most favorite films of all time. Like, I absolutely loved it. It was such a beautiful film. It was, I just loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it. My tip to people, and this is something I'm trying to lean into, is like, not just kind of drop the rock and just share your writing. Because ultimately that's what's standing in the way between like writing, then sharing it, getting feedback, and then getting it to a place where then you can maybe produce it or direct it, whatever you want to do. And I think for newer writers, there's a lot of like that really loud inner critic, perfectionism. Is it good? Is it not? Like, not everybody thinks they're a writer. Like myself, I don't consider myself a screenwriter, but I'm like, I need to know enough to write an idea to share, to get it produced. Because I know what I like on screen. I know what I think needs to get made. So that's important. Okay, Shauna, you're not a genre agnostic director, right? Or are you like only like in horror or what genres are you like?
I would say my two favorite genres are science fiction and horror. I've loved them since I was a kid. The kid of one of my mom's friends showed me A Nightmare on Elm Street, and oh gosh, I think I was probably about 5 or 6, and he also showed me Evil Dead 2 when I was probably about 7 or 8, so I've been obsessed with horror since then. My father got me into Star Trek, which is so funny because he's not a Trekkie, but I'm a diehard Star Trek fan. I can say I've seen every single on-screen iteration of Star Trek. I've watched Deep Space Nine twice. I love Star Trek. I actually had a friend came over for a sleepover. I made her watch Star Trek with me. I'm like, I am not missing Star Trek just to impress you. But I also really love action. My script supervillainous is like superhero action story, but with a young female lead. And yeah, I'm really big into action. I also love crime stories. I've done crime stuff, but I've also mixed it with supernatural stuff, so that's always fun. I love historical dramas. I can't imagine writing one, though, but I've definitely seen at least 7 different iterations of, like, Pride and Prejudice. Love them all. I'm like, Mr. Darcy, I get the appeal.
yeah. That's a very popular remake and inspired work for a lot of different writers and filmmakers. Shauna, I was going to say, like, since this mental health awareness, we were talking about any films that you recall that did a good job or a bad job depicting women with mental health issues. And I right away think of Fatal Attraction, but that's an old one. And then what was that movie with the one about the was it Misery?
Yes, that's terrifying film. What's interesting, there is a 1940s film called The Snake Pit. I believe it's based off a novel, and it's about a woman being institutionalized, and it's scary and harrowing, and it does get, like, when they finally get to her treatment, it is a lot of Freudian stuff of, like, your mother was this way and your father was like that. So, like, the stuff is dated, but I would say it was, like, the first time I'd ever seen a story. It was the oldest movie I'd ever seen about mental health where someone was institutionalized and she wasn't a murderer. She wasn't terrifying. It was like treated as mental illness was treated as an illness rather than something to just be shut away and ignored. And it's an amazing film. I highly recommend The Snake Pit. And even though, like, the treatment is quite dated, thankfully there's no, like, cold treatment or anything like that, because that would be horrifying. It's like, yeah, she needs talk therapy. And, like, it's an amazing film. And yeah.
It's called The Snake Pit. And it came out in the 1940s.
The late 40s, I believe. I could double check that.
I have never heard of it, but I feel like since it's a 1940s film, it's going to be quite a interesting film to watch.
It's 1948, actually. It's 1948, and it got the Academy Award for Best Sound Mixing.
Oh, wow. Sound mixing in 1948, okay. I was thinking of some of the films I've watched that I think had a really raw and real depiction of mental health, maybe not necessarily women characters, but maybe we can help our audience kind of come up with some of their own. Girl Interrupted, for sure. I love that film. I thought the performances were amazing by all. I really felt every character there. Then Trainspotting, which dealt with the heroin addiction, that was pretty disturbingly real. It was jarring. And the recent Joker with Joaquin Phoenix. His mom and him, the character, both. Todd Phillips directed, what was it, 2022?
I think so. And I loved how a thing that really stood out to me was that in a lot of ways it was society failed him. He fell through the cracks, and it's like, oh, if that social safety net had been there, the ending of the movie would not have happened. it's like, oh, budget cuts led to all these problems. And that's what we're seeing in real life right now, is like our social safety net is being torn apart. Housing is too expensive. And I know, like, recently, like, Gavin Newsom has been like, you need to arrest your homeless. And it's like, that's not a solution. It's like, no. And I too often hear people complain about, well, mentally ill or they're on drugs that needs to be taken care of. And it's like, well, you can't solve those problems if you don't have permanent housing.
No, you're making a very important point because, yes, in Joker, the ending, without ruining the ending, the film's been out for like 3.5 years now, so people, very dystopian ending, a lot of psychotic breaks, but that's very present-day Los Angeles, downtown L.A. People are just, even Santa Monica, unfortunately, it's a mental health crisis. There's a lot of just people who are untreated, untreated for their mental health, and they're attacking people. And I'm not trying to be irresponsible with this information, but you can Google it. There's just people getting pushed onto train tracks because someone is in a psychotic episode. It's just, it's really sad. And you're right. Like, how these films, as raw as they are, some like Fatal Attraction, some as poetic as Girl Interrupted, some as raw and like as Trainspotting, they do an important job of mirroring what society is doing. And right now, I think, I don't know about New York, but here at least, I don't think there's a solution to just end it all. What we can start doing is providing resources, which is what we've talked about in a few other episodes with other guests, is like, what is that, though?
I think a big problem also is that mental health care is so expensive in this country. Looking into a therapy, and like, so many therapists don't take insurance because insurance does not pay out well. And, you know, you will call places and they're like, well, you could see us out of pocket. It's $250. It's $300. And I'm like, how is someone supposed to pay that weekly? And it's like, insurance should not only just cover it, but should pay the doctors. Like, they are doctors. It's like, come on. They had to pay a lot of money to go to school to train for this. They cannot be getting $20 for that. And the amount we pay for insurance, it should be genuinely covered, whether it's in-network or out-of-network. And I think all people should have access, whether you're on Medicaid or if you're, you know, have Platinum Plus amazing insurance. Like, income should not get in the way of access to healthcare, whether it's for your mind or your body. And I do think housing goes a long way towards solving that. And yet New York right now, that's an issue where our housing prices just keep going up and up and up and up. And there are all these new, like, massive high-rise buildings going up in downtown Brooklyn, and half of them are empty because no one can afford them. Yet there are people living on the street. And I'm just like, why are we building more luxury condos? Like, there are only so many rich people in the world.
Yeah, no, it's a cluster F of a situation, and it's kind of like a doom cycle, right? Like, yeah, because there's really not a solution, because no one's really looking at it holistically. And like I said, I'm not an expert on this by any means, but just working in spaces on projects before that dealt with mental health issues and recovery, as a societal benefit, as a country, for overall social well-being, community well-being, we should have at least, just like the arts program that has been defunded through our current presidency, we should have an increase of supported mental health programs for people who either are impoverished, lower income, who aren't working or don't have access to it, that can go in and maybe, like, I don't know, for not $200 a session, but maybe a community situation. And I'm sure there's a way we can do that, because we can make anything happen if we truly want to. But what it feels like is that these problems just continue to grow, and we're not looking at it in that way because there's no money to be made. And it's more of like well-being. And we're very driven by profit. Not we, but like whoever's like facilitating or figuring out solutions. It's like, you know, profitability is driving motivating factor, I think, in all of this. And it's not profitable to give away free, like as a government, you could like pay your therapist and then give free mental health checks to people who don't have insurance.
Yeah. What Matthew Desmond did, this, he wrote this amazing book called Poverty by America. And it, you know, one of the young women he talks to in the book, she's like, was abused by her stepfather. She's been dealing with mental health problems. She's poverty stricken. She's aged out of the system. And it's like so difficult for her to like find housing, get mental health care, to find work. And it's like she wants all of these things. And I think so often there's this attitude of they're lazy. And it's like, no, it's not laziness. It's hard being poor. It's so hard. It's hard work to be poor. And the thing that's so crazy is it costs all of us in society. And it's not just the cost of our parks don't look pretty and the streets are dirty. It is financially expensive to keep a section of society poor. It's so expensive because it's like, we should just do the universal basic income, but there's just this attitude of, well, they need to be not lazy and get jobs. But it's like all these things where it's like we're spending all this money to like make people go to these like jobs training classes that are ineffective. And then like having them report on how many resumes they've sent in and doing this and doing that. And it's like, you know what costs less? Giving this person $1,000 a month and letting them figure their stuff out. Like they found with the, I think it was like during COVID, they did like a special thing with the child income tax credit. And they found most families put that towards like paying rent or childcare, buying groceries.
Yeah, no, I mean, those are staples and those are necessities. And where we are right now in the world, economically, at least nationally for Americans, it's a very tough time for majority of Americans. I think also one of the stigmas attached to someone dealing with a mental health, untreated mental health issue is that people aren't lazy. People are depressed. Their chemicals are not balanced. So when you're not, you don't have the motivation because you're chemically imbalanced. You can't show up. That's the problem. That is the invisible illness, the mental health aspect of it, where we're criminalizing a portion of untreated, maybe people who don't have adequate health care, who would get checked, or the stigma around it. You know, many times people talk them. I mean, just I deal with anxiety and depression, and I know it's like you have to be really honest and check in with yourself. But if you're dealing with even stronger mental health issues, like I said, I'm not a doctor, not giving away any information here. How you don't know until you're depressed, until you're in a depressive episode, at least for me. And it's one of those things that once people are on the other side of the issue, now it's like you can't expect someone with a mental health issue to understand and process things the way someone who is overall healthy would. And that is the stigma, I think, attached with mental health and criminalizing that. Because a lot of people who are homeless or even driven to drugs, it comes from trauma. It comes from something that's either undiagnosed or a pain that hasn't been, addressed. And so I don't know, Shauna, this is a very dystopian topic, but very much needed. Because I think, I don't know where we are now. It's not a pretty place. I know on a personal note for me, I have a lot of compassion for people who deal with that stuff because it's not a choice. It's just not a choice. If you have bipolar disorder or bipolar 2 or any of those, it's and you don't know that you have it and you're going through life untreated and the world is reflecting back your behavior and you're in the prison system or you're like getting in trouble in situations at work, you don't know what's going on. It's kind of scary and sad, yeah. You know, like,
well, I would say I was very impressed with this year, like we got the first season of The Pitt on HBO and they had multiple episodes about people experiencing mental health crises. And the fact that the show wasn't just like story of the week, but instead of like continuous story, you got to see how. Yeah, I remember there was this like one character where you saw him off his medication and he was terrifying. And then you see him on his medication a few episodes later and he is completely coherent. And they have a discussion about the fact that he's homeless. It's hard for him to get medication. And him trying to figure out how to make that happen so he's not scary guy on the street. And I thought it was such an amazing thing that the way that the whole series handled that. But then it also presented the realistic fact of sometimes you just don't know how it turns out because the person will have left the emergency room and they don't come back because of stigma or lack of money. Lack of housing, and you just don't know. And I thought that was such an amazingly done thing. I'd say is this year my like favorite depiction of both mental health and homelessness and what it's like for doctors, because you know I have multiple family members that have been nurses and doctors, family members that have served in the military, and it's tough work. It's very, very tough work.
No, this is a very important discussion, and I'm glad we're having it. It's not always pleasant to talk about this, but it's important to talk about this, right? Like, I think that's the whole idea. Like, talking about this stuff makes it lessens the stigma around it. So now, because both of us are filmmakers, producers, and writers in our own right, we've both worked on projects. Let's close our segment out with Canary Trap. Now, tell us the log line and what that short film that you wrote and what about why this film and how did you approach directing your talent and tackling this mental health issue?
Yeah, so Canary Trap, I started writing all the way back in March 2020. A producer had said, you know, she wanted to do a story about schizophrenia, interestingly enough. And I started writing in, you know, came up with all these ideas. Sadly, the producer lost interest, but I was like, I'm going to stick with this. And I ended up kind of pivoting as I did more research and moved away from this concrete, it's schizophrenia kind of thing. Because ultimately, it's the story of someone that thinks she's a spy. And she goes through this like crisis of like this voice calling her and telling her, you need to do these things, you need to do that thing. And her eventually realizing, oh my God, my dad is not interrupting my important work. My dad is checking on me. And yet, a big thing for me was while doing research was realizing that not every mental health diagnosis is this. Concrete, it's definitely that. Because if you look at the symptoms with it that are displayed in the film, it's like she could be schizophrenic, but she could also have bipolar disorder. And there's like the complication of, okay, if you're not sure which it is, how do you treat this person? And it for me, it was important to tell a story where we get it from her point of view, but also don't make her scary. And I didn't want the police getting involved. And you know, initially when it was written, it was just kind of this like, twist, she's crazy. And that wasn't working. Like as much as I wanted to make it work, that works on the page as you're just like, oh, I didn't expect that. But it eventually came to the catharsis, the realization at the end was her calling her father and saying, Dad, I need help.
I wanted to say, Shauna, I watched your film And I think you really did a great job of depicting mental health in a positive framework where we understand that if it's there is a supportive system, her father, the character's father, is checking in on her. There's also, I think, like I said, there's so many stories. And as storytellers, we have a responsibility of what kind of art we make. And it's subjective. But I think you handled schizophrenia very well because it wasn't criminalized in real life.
It's actually in between, I would say she's more bipolar. It's something that, I discussed with a friend that's a therapist. I reached out to her, discussed with someone that have bipolar disorder. Because I was like, I did not want to make a story where someone going through a crisis watches it and is like, oh, is that what I look like? Like, I did not want that because that doesn't make you want to get help. That makes you want to figure out how to hide it more. And it's also something that in telling the story, I wanted people that if they recognize that in their own family members or their friends, that they know reaching out is important, to keep reaching out and keep reaching out and keep supporting. And just because someone says I'm okay doesn't mean they're okay. They may want help and don't know how to ask for it, but as long as you're there to offer it, they can eventually be like, yes, I need that help.
I love that. And no, I like I said, I think you did a great job of telling a story where it wasn't centered around her trauma, and you had compassion for the character, but it also provided solutions and community, and how important that is. And you're right, when someone is going through a mental crisis or episode of any kind, whatever they're dealing with mentally, those irrational thoughts, they do self-isolate. They don't want help, and it's important for us to check in on our friends or our family, loved ones, if we suspect they're going through something, because it's harder. People usually retreat when they get sick. So it is one of those things. Are you overstepping? Are you not? So I think there's a healthy way, I guess, to figure out how we interject as friends and family members. But I think you did a great job. And I think that's one of the responsible things as filmmakers, that if we're going to write, and this is my opinion, if we're going to create stories and actors with real mental health issues, I think a compassionate framework is important, where we can have these discussions like we're having right now. So if someone is dealing with someone, they're not triggered with shame, like, oh my God, I went through a depressive episode, how embarrassing. It's real, you know? It's a passing phase, and there's ways that you can get healthier. So I think that's important. I was going to say, we are almost out of time, Shauna, like always. So I'm going to continue our conversation at a later date. But I was going to say, like, what is the status of Canary Trap right now? Are you still screening this?
So it's premiering, well, I guess by the time this airs, this will have passed. But May 17th, it's going to be at African American Women in Cinema Film Festival. So I'm very excited about that and waiting to hear back from more festivals. I could say that has been a present day mental health crisis for me, is just like waiting for these emails, and then you get the rejections and it's like, oh my God, am I good enough? But you still have to put yourself out there, because if you don't submit your film, it's not going to be accepted. So, and the rejections suck, but the few times that we've gotten into festivals, we got into like SoCal Film Awards, which gave Canary Trap an honorable mention. So that was very, very nice. I got into New York Shorts International Film Festival. That was like a very fun experience, getting to see the film on a big screen and have people ask me questions about it and be like, oh my God, I'm so nervous, I need to answer this coherently. So yeah, that has been exciting. And I'm hoping to make some more announcements in the near future.
Well, I'm going to ask you two questions before we close out, Shauna, because, you know, first of all, what kind of character are you going to create next in your film? What character are you creating right now? Would you like to create?
Well, I'm currently working on a kind of, I guess I'd say it's a werewolf transformation story, but it's a woman that's just gone through a divorce, and now she's had the complication of being bitten by a werewolf added onto all of that. So, and yet, the end of a marriage is very, end of any relationship is very hard, whether or not you want it. There's just that whole, like, oh my god, I've been this married person for however many years, and now my life is going to change. And I know I wanted it to change, but I don't know if I'm ready for that change that as of yet. It's been a very fun story to write, but also, like, ooh, I could put all my anxiety right into this thing. So,
As someone who's gone through that process, if you ever need research, I can, you know, give you some sad moments. But that, of course, I'm on the other side of it now. But I was going to say, that's the whole genre of films right there, divorce stories. Like, I mean, seriously, at some point, I'm going to put together a list of films that deal with, like, there was a marriage story, but, like, list of, like, divorce stories, because that itself is a genre,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, like, I saw they remade... what's that movie? War of the Roses, the Michael Douglas film, and now it's going to be The Roses with Olivia Colman and Benedict Cumberbatch. And I'm just like, I used to love War of the Roses as a kid, but, like, as an adult, I'm like, do I really want to watch that?
It's real. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Shauna. I hope we had fun today being our co-host. I mean, yes, we talked about important stuff. I hope this conversation sparked something in you, whether it was about storytelling or mental health or the power of creative community. Do you have a call to action for our audience before we sign off?
Go to the movies. It's fun, and it's something you could do by yourself and just, like, let your mind escape for a while, whether it's, you know, you go see Friendship and have a great laugh, or you go and see Sinners and get terrified. Oh my god, the new Final Destination movie's coming out, and I'm like, I love seeing every accident I am terrified of happening, being like, yes, someone else understands that it's terrifying to drive behind a log truck. Thank you. It's like, so I'm very excited for the new Final Destination movies. It's like one of my favorite movie series. I can watch those movies over and over again. I have watched them over and over again. So,
wow. Yeah. No, that's a good one. That's a good one. Yes. Thank you. So, like Shauna said, your voice matters, and we need more stories from the inside out. So until next time, this is the Slow Dive Podcast. I am Farida. Please take some time today to listen, reflect, and connect. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Slow Dive. Please be sure to subscribe and give us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq and edited by Drew Franzblau. Our theme music is Dive by Ciro.